priority effects means essentially that the outcome of interactions or community assembly is based on arrival order, you know, of the species. And that's not stochastic. And actually, I can show you two own data that it's super deterministic. But the problem is we don't have data on arrival order in 99.999% of all the cases. If you look at an early life microbiome, you have no idea when the baby, you know, put something into his or her mouth. So there's some really interesting literature, but stochasticity is part to it and is probably one of the really exciting aspects of it.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series on leveraging microbial ecology for health. In this series, we speak with experts about shaping microbial ecosystems using various tools, including biotics, to create positive effects on health.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest on the podcast, I'm delighted to welcome Jens Walter. And Jens is, as we were just saying, off mic, about 3 feet away from me as we record this, because he's my neighbor here in APC Microbiome Ireland. But Jens has traveled the world. I think he spent time in New Zealand, in Nebraska, and Canada, before finally ending up here at APC Microbiome Ireland in Cork. And Jens, if I was to introduce you or to describe your expertise to somebody, I call you a microbial ecologist. Would you agree with that? And can you tell us what a microbial ecologist is, if you agree with that?
So first, I do agree with that. Yeah, I try to apply ecological and evolutionary frameworks to understand microbiomes. And then I try to apply this to modulate microbiomes, you know, using these, you know, basic kind of scientific principles. And to your second question, you know, what is ecology? You know, it's the study of communities and their interactions within the communities and with their surrounding, you know, and in terms of a microbiome, that would be the host. Yeah, but obviously ecology goes wider than that. You know, we have, you know, macroecology as a biologist that look into, you know, rainforests and deserts and animal, you know, communities, you know. So, but we actually, in the microbiome field, we are trying to use some of these concepts from macroecology and try to apply them now to the microbiome. Yes, my group has done this in the past, specifically, you know, using animal models, but then also to apply it to humans, specifically then more translational studies where we actually try to, you know, modulate microbiomes in, you know, human nutrition and probiotic trials specifically.
Yeah, I hope we get a chance to discuss that during this podcast. But can you tell me, like, ecology, you talk about applying frameworks and models. Is ecology, and I'm going to insult you now, is it qualitative or quantitative? Is it mathematical or is it more descriptive and kind of instinctive almost?
I mean, I would think it's both. You know, I think I have to admit, you know, a lot of ecologists, you know, are working often, you know, with mathematics, you know, and I have to admit that a lot of my reading in this field over the last 20 years was, you know, that there are a lot of papers that are completely over my head, you know, so I go into these, you know, column, then often I actually read the introduction and the discussion and I get something out of it, you know, but the results are essentially mathematical models, you know, and I have to say, I don't have the training, you know, to understand this. So, but what I try is to at least, you know, learn something from this, you know, and then still apply the concept. So from you saying, so the field can be quite mathematical, but that wouldn't really be me. I think my studies are more, I wouldn't call them instinctive, but they're probably more hypothesis driven. You know, and then it's more experimental, actually, instead of mathematical.
And the microbiome, I mean, is an ecological system, a very, very complex ecological system, highly densely populated. Well, again, it depends on which area of the gut you're talking about, I guess. And maybe you can expand on that a little bit. To what extent are these microbes, the very odd way of putting it, behaving mathematically? And to what extent are they organic and life forms? And there's a high element of stochasticity or randomness in the system.
And there is a high amount of stochasticity, but that's actually an internal part of ecology. And it's actually something that has interested me quite a bit in my past studies, you know, because we have studies actually on priority effects, for example, which are often, you know, put more into the stochastic realm. So if you look into basic ecology frameworks, for example, you know, then there's often the differentiation actually between stochastic and deterministic, you know. And there was even in, if you look into the early 2000s, there was almost kind of a contentious debate around this, you know. And actually, I don't know if might have heard, you know, that when this neutral model of ecology was published, it was actually really controversial, you know, as a meaning that, you know, communities assemble essentially, you know, by random, you know, and it's not based on traits, you know, or at least at certain trophic levels, that it is essentially random. And I think the basic ecology has advanced, and now it's really that stochastic and deterministic elements, you know, work together. And I think priority effects are a really interesting area. And again, we in animals, we can actually control for this. So I think it's a combination of the two. And then there's also some really interesting theoretical work, which actually say there is probably no such thing as stochastic. It is really just that a lot of measurements are just so poor, you know, that at the end, the outcome is stochastic. But in effect, it was all deterministic, but it, you know, that's not how we measure it. And actually, again, priority effects are a super example there, because priority effects means essentially that the outcome of interactions or community assembly is based on arrival order, you know, of the species. And that's not stochastic. And actually, I can show you two own data that it's super deterministic. But the problem is we don't have data on arrival order in 99.999% of all the cases. If you look at an early life microbiome, you have no idea when the baby, you know, put something into his or her mouth. So there's some really interesting literature, but stochasticity is part to it, and is probably one of the really exciting aspects of it. Yeah.
Let's talk about specificity, because part of what is characteristic of your work, Jens, is that you make really pointed and good criticisms of emerging concepts. So I noticed with prebiotics, you know, specificity has always been an important concept, but you pointed out that there's limitations in measurement that cause us that we can't sometimes understand how a substrate may actually benefit a lot of different taxa. And so you've kind of argued that we need to expand what we mean by specificity. So can you talk about like how our understanding of the resources that are available to organisms influence what causes the ultimate community to evolve, and why it's difficult to shape the ultimate microbiome?
Yeah, so specificity is an important one. But I'm actually not so much critical on the concept of specificity. I'm doubtful that specificity can be used to characterize a prebiotic. And the reason for that is because I find it very difficult to draw the line. You know, so this is actually, it's more of a definition. And I know, Dan, we were on the same paper and we had a lot of discussions around this. So I'm actually quite fascinated with how specific dietary fiber structures can be, you know, and we've worked ourselves on resistant starches with just slight differences. And then, you know, when you do this with all the noise and all the variation, but they are still kind of going into different directions. And we actually are working on a unpublished data set at the moment, where again, two different dietary fiber structures even direct short chain fatty acids in two different directions, again, with noise and with you know, variation, but it still works. So I have no doubt that works, and I'm actually more fascinated. Well, how specific? So in this paper we are currently working, we are testing an Acacia gum and a resistant starch type 4, and they are highly selective, and there is not a single overlap in the actual species that at least show statistically significant changes. Yeah. So also this idea to use a specific resource and use the chemical structure of this, you know, resource, you know, to then direct the microbiome, and this is in human trials, seems to work actually quite well. When it comes to my doubt was really more than, you know, now that you know this, if you now define a prebiotic, you know, as this compound that causes a selective effect or specific effect, which is in a lot of these definitions, after working on it for 20 years, I still don't mean or know what that exactly means. You know, is it one species? Is it three? Is it half the microbiome? And then another issue that I have, if you actually, and I had discussions with this with, you know, scientists who study you know, sugars in fermenters and stuff. And I've heard from them, if you put fructose or glucose into an actual fermenter with a complex microbiome, they are hugely selective. And the reason is there are just some bacteria that grow really, really fast and good, and under a competitive environment, you enrich it. Might well be E. coli or something like that, you know, if it's under certain conditions, you know, but they are selective, you know. So perhaps that's another, you know, criticism that I have is, you know, that I don't even know, you know, to what degree it actually means. But it's all in relation then, you know, to the health effect and to the definition of prebiotics. I do think you can make selective changes to the microbiome through dietary fibers.
And going back to the idea that you were talking about priority effects and how an ecosystem builds up, I guess. And babies, we believe, are born sterile or very close to sterile. You had a wonderful paper in Nature with a whole host of authors about 2 years ago, considering whether whether there is such a thing as a fetal microbiome. And I think concluding that there is not. There are issues, technological issues, with trying to prove that, but it looks like there isn't really a fetal microbiome. So you've got this blank space with lots of nutrients, nice and warm, protected from the environment, no oxygen. And you're going to get a community now is going to build within that framework or that environment. Is your thought process that environment will counter essentially every microorganism that exists, and it will select its own members out from that vast plethora of bacteria it will encounter? Or that the first guy in dictates the second guy, which dictates the third, the fourth, the fifth, as you said, in a very, very deterministic way? And if the second, or closer to the second, should we be doing something about that with newborn babies?
So that's very good, very good question. So first thing is, so in ecology, it's always a combination of things, but it is probably closer to the second, you know, as of this, you know, that you have this assembly process, but the assembly process still happens then obviously with, you know, you are selecting for the adapted members. But clearly early on, there is very little selection, you know, as everybody, everything can come in. Actually, we have with germ-free mice, we have an excellent models. You know, you can put Lactococcus lactis, and actually scientists do this, you know, can put them into germ-free mice and it colonizes like heaven. And also, if you look into a newborn baby, you know, these early colonizers is always E. coli and Staphylococcus, you know, and you see these a lot of opportunistic, you know, kind of pathogens. And then in a C-section baby, you would have even more of these, you know, because the adapted bacteria, you know, are interrupted. So you have this, but then obviously selection, you know, takes hold and it becomes, you know, it selects for the right species. But then within that, there would still potentially be these priority effects or these successions, you know, that meaning that, you know, it depends on which bifidobacterium strain or which species. And this then, and again, there are studies, you know, that this might still then be dependent on who actually came first. And also, you know, what then the long-term trajectories are, you know, that's, for example, there are some really nice work on bifidobacterium infantis strain, you know, that David Mills discovered 15 years ago. And they put this into early life newborns and it reaches 90% of the community, you know, and after 3-4 months. So I do think that at least to some degree, this is caused by early colonization priority effect in that is called niche preemption. That bug is at first it's adapted, but then it also came first. So I think it's a combination of adaptation and these priority effects. And then it's also important, priority effects actually work within niches. So this means, you know, if two bacteria are not, or they partition niches, as it means they don't really colonize with each other. They actually are not affected by priority effects. They just persist both, yeah? But if they really, really colonize the same niche, they actually exclude each other. And then who wins in this? And we showed this in what I thought is a really elegant mouse study. Within this ecological niche, then priority effects are massive, you know, especially if both members are adapted. Yeah. And if you look into, again, talking about basic ecology, there is this coexistence theory. And it's actually, this is basically an interaction between how much adapted they are and how much they partition niches. So if they are all, you know, if they're all similar adapted, they can persist, you know, and then they basically just hang out. And the more, the closer their niches is, essentially, they have to become more and more similar adapted. And if that doesn't happen, you know, they basically just exclude each other. And then to your last question, should we make use of this? You know, I think we still need to know what we are actually doing. But at least from what I see in the field is the ability to modulate microbiomes and perhaps even change trajectories is dramatic in early life. And I was involved in a study by Marie-Claire Ayeta, for example, where she, in preterm babies, you know, where they use mixtures of probiotics and they put them in the first 2 weeks, and they really just stick on. And you know, they did strain-specific PCR, you know, and they are there for 3, 4, 5 months. And not only are they, you know, stably colonizing, they are also then changing the entire trajectory, also the maturation path of the other microbiome, you know, because they're keystone species or microbiome engineers or whatever, you know, term you want to use. So I think there is dramatic possibility there from an ecological point of view. But then clinically, you know, what exactly one, and I think, you know, there's a really good argument to put bifidobacterium that are highly adapted early in life. But I guess we still need more studies, you know, but ecologically, I would say there's a lot of possibility there. Yeah.
Since we are so interested a lot of times in trying to modulate the microbiome, you kind of approach it from an ecological perspective and kind of bring ecological principles to bear to try to understand when are we going to have manipulation and when aren't we. Can you talk to us about some of the kind of important principles that you use in trying to identify when can we achieve a modulation of the microbiome?
There's a way. It is a few years ago, but we published a paper about engraftment, for example, you know, and that was very much focused on probiotics. But it was nice because then years later, we also applied it in a study on fecal microbiota transplants. But what we did is, again, we went into the basic ecology literature. And actually here we looked into a field called invasion ecology. And this is this obviously very relevant field in macroecology, you know, that deals with biological invasions, you know, as a meaning we have invasive species that are a real problem because they invade ecosystems, you know, and then they cause havoc, you know. So really we looked into this literature and then basically just, you know, applied some principles, you know, to how can we perhaps have probiotics invade, although that's a dangerous term, you know. But when you look into this field, so we came up with this graph that it's a combination, you know, of the characteristics of the incoming organism or the mixture of organisms. And that's not only the organism, but also, you know, in what amount it comes, how often it comes. That's, for example, in ecology, they call that propagule pressure, I think, yeah. And then it's the characteristics of the host also, and it's the characteristics of the actual community that, again, are the niches already occupied? You know, what is the competition for resources? Is there an open niche, for example, for this incoming strain to basically, you know, create a hole?
And that paper, it seemed like you contrast invader from a colonizer, right? Like a colonizer may be considered where it's...
And I mean, I guess the an invader and a colonizer is probably ecologically the same thing, you know, but the problem is that some of these colonizers then become really destructive to ecosystems. And I'm actually, at least I'm not aware that in the probiotic field that has ever happened, you know, that also, you know, that it's more, you know, that probiotics don't colonize. But in this, in invasion ecology, that's one of the things they are studying, you know. But it's at the end, it is still that you have these invasion species, you know, has to basically come in, get a niche, establish in the niche, and then start interacting with the surrounding community. If you want to establish a modulation, you know, obviously, in the probiotic field, we are not trying to, you know, disrupt. But even actually, even this, there's this National Geographic article that was just published, and I've actually really just looked at it. And I have to say, some of the claims in here are pretty crazy, you know, as a meaning that you know, scientists claim, you know, that there are examples where probiotics are almost like invasive fish or something, completely causing havoc, you know. So it is thrown around, but I'm just not aware of a single example, at least in the probiotic space, you know, that actually happened.
Yeah, we'll provide a link to that paper in the show notes. But I want to shift to adults. So when you're an established microbiome, so we're not talking anymore about assembling, but an established microbiome, and your recent work, and we talked in a recent podcast to Anissa about this, and she was fascinating in discussing the NIMI diet and your attempts are your actual success in manipulating the microbiome, established microbiomes, by changing diet. Diet, I guess, is one of the main drivers of an ecosystem. It's not the physical. To what extent do you think, I guess what I'm asking is, to what extent does the fact that it's at 37 degrees and moist and there's lots of mucus and lots of other bacteria breaking things down, to what extent does that determine the composition of an ecological system and this outside force of diet coming into that ecosystem? What's the balance there, do you think? Who's controlling most?
So there are some really big, you know, population level studies, you know, that look at essentially the different factors that explain variation in a human population. You know, and this data is actually there are many studies now, and it's pretty well established that, for example, and there were lots of surprises there actually in these studies, you know. And if you summarize this, so for example, diet is probably only explaining 3-4%, you know, of the total variation in a human population. Actually, host genetics is probably also around 5%. You know, some say 2 to 10, but it's definitely very little. And then you have medical history. You know, actually, you know, John Ras's group showed, you know, that transit time is actually the largest of all these factors, which is also influenced by diet, actually. But that even that, again, adds up to 4%. And then interestingly, in these studies, and they're quite consistent about this, it's only around 20, maximum 25% of the variation that you can explain in a population based on these deterministic factors. The other 75 to 80%, they are just not known. And then obviously we in our papers make the argument this is, you know, stochastic or something like priority effect or other stochastic elements. Yeah. But going to our NIMI study, that was definitely one of our surprises, because it was pretty much in agreement with these large observation studies, in that we completely changed a diet of Canadians, you know, to this non-industrialized type diet, completely controlled it, in that we gave every single meal to them, did this big study, did all the sequencing, and then ran, you know, the permanovas on it. And then at the end, what we found is that the diet has a highly significant effect, but it explains 1.5% of the variation in this data set. So meaning there's a huge amount of individuality, and then only because all of them eat the same diet, they are not becoming more similar. They actually got slightly more different. It's a tiny effect, but they definitely don't become more similar, and it only still explains 1.5% of the variation. So in terms of composition, we are not achieving much with the diet. And that's probably also an important take-home message out of this discussion here. You know, I think we achieve a lot in terms of function. And obviously, that's another, it's also part of ecology, you know, that you think about, you know, what are the functional consequences of whatever you're doing, you know. So in terms of composition, we achieve very, very little in terms of the metabolite, pH, short chain fatty acids, even microbial metabolites that you can detect in blood. We can achieve much, much more with this diet. And what's also interesting, we see a lot of variation in the responses in the microbiome, and we see at least less variation if you look in the, you know, inter-individual variation in the responses when it comes to the metabolites, you know, which again ecologically makes sense, because there's this concept of functional redundancy, you know, that although we are all different, you know, our microbiomes are at least in most cases still doing kind of similar things. And that obviously you can capitalize on if you completely change your diet and you give 45 grams of fiber a day.
Can we talk about diet in a longer-term context? You've done work, and Colin and I are also interested in how the Neolithic diet and changes, you know, the introduction of starch and milk has changed what our gut microbes look like and the implications that has for health and disease. Would you like to kind of give us a little primer on what we should know as people now with facing a lot of chronic disease about how the composition of our diet influences our gut health?
I mean, it's a topic that I find super fascinating. And it's probably less ecology and more evolution. But obviously, you know, as humans, we have evolved with diets. And I think there is no such thing as one ancestral diet. But what is pretty clear is that whatever the ancestral diet was, it's very different than the Western Americanized diet that we are eating today. And I think that has likely consequences. And obviously, that's something, you know, both in the nutrition field, but also in the microbiome field, is probably one of the contributors, you know, why we perhaps lose certain species of diversity, but then also that our own body and the symbiosis that we have with the microbes is pretty maladapted to these diets that we are eating now. And that was the main motivation of this study with this non-industrialized type diet. You know, we thought, look, can you turn that back, you know? And the answer was actually in the study was pretty clear. In terms of composition, we can't turn it back. We actually, the diversity even dropped slightly in the study. So we didn't become more diverse and we didn't become more like a, you know, non-industrialized rainforest human population, you know, but functionally, I think we could achieve things as of, so in terms of, you know, much more fermentation, even certain shifts in metabolites, you know, we're more similar than, you know, to these non-industrialized populations. Yeah. I don't know if that was, if that answers your questions. Yeah. So.
And Jens, is there a priori kind of assumption there that we would be healthier if we had the pre-industrial microbiome? Or is it possible that our microbiome has evolved with us to this current state and is actually much better for us than a pre-industrial microbiome would be? I would guess, you know, if you took a pre-industrialized human and gave them the amount of alcohol a modern human can consume, their livers would have trouble with it. Is it possible that our microbiomes are just right for this industrial diet? Or do you think we could really improve our health by pushing those back in time, but not anything else around us back in time?
I mean, obviously, you know, none of that can be directly tested. But the reason is why I still think there is a lot of, though I do like, and I know this discussion, and I followed it quite a bit, and there's some really interesting papers and even New York Times article about, but the I do think we are, in fact, you know, misadapted. Specifically, the diet is misadapted to our microbiome, you know, and the microbiome changes to what degree they are functionally important. That's very hard to test. But even there, I can see, you know, certain negative outcomes. And the reason for this is that I think the time frames to readapt are not long enough. Yeah. And if you look into the literature, for example, of, you know, symbiosis, which has a very, very big literature, and, you know, you have these long-term evolved symbiotic, you know, relationships, and they evolve in certain environmental contexts. And there is a lot of example when the environment actually shifts too fast, the symbiosis break. Yeah. And there are some really painful examples. For example, coral bleaching would be an example. You know, so these are symbionts. Temperature of the water gets too high and the coral is essentially pushing the symbiont out and essentially, you know, can't exist anymore. So, you know, you can't tell the coral, yeah, just the depth of the water increase. You know, so it's just, you know, it's not, that might happen in 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 years. But that's not, and this is, so I do not think the time frame, especially with the really bad industrialized food that we're eating, which is a seriously a thing of probably the last 30, 40 years. It's even, you know, industrialized revolution did certain changes, but I think this really industrialized foods with all its emulsifiers at really low fiber, that's probably a thing of the last 50 years. So this time span is not long enough. But then another really important thing for this relationship to readapt, as what you say, you know, for this microbiome to become right for us, you need actual mechanisms by which selection can act. And that's also not happening. Because if you think we are talking about chronic diseases, you know, that are skyrocketing, you know, they do not reduce the amount of offspring you generate. You know, as you know, when we talk about obesity, multiple sclerosis, IBD and things, so the evolution or at least natural selection can only happen, you know, when you actually select. And selection means you have to influence the amount of offspring. And evolutionary, you know, if you have the right bacteria early life and then you have infant mortalities of what, 50, 60, 70%, which we probably would have had throughout human evolution, that's really selecting for the right microbe-host interactions. But now to correct for this chronic disease-inducing microbiome, which I really think we have, or at least we have a chronic disease-inducing interrelationship of our microbiome with the diet, I don't think we are selecting against that.
Jens, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I would love you to join again. And yeah, that was good fun. Thanks, both of you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.